This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Yes, hello, welcome along. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is the show from Fun Kids, all about the amazing, weird and dangerous things in the universe that we call science. We do it every 7 days, which is why we've given it the name we have. Now, my name's Dan, and what have we got for you today then? Actually, I don't know why I'm asking you that. The goods are all my end, aren't they? I'm the one that's got to tell you. We'll learn about the most deadly creatures in the jungle, right? It's the size of a paperclip, and ancient tribes have used its poison to capture prey for centuries. Also, we'll learn what would happen if we lived without gravity, and we'll chat to a computer programmer in just a sec who can help teach us about the future. First, it's all aboard the Fun Kids submarine. With Sean and Robot from our breakfast show, today we're going deep.
Sean's science around ships.
Hello, it's Sean and Robot here, and we are on the Fun Kids submarine today. Yep, that's right. Fun Kids have splashed out on their own personal submarine. I think that's where your pay rise has gone, Robot. Anyway, we're getting to the bottom of some seriously bozy bamboozlers. Getting to the bottom, you know, like the bottom of the ocean. Right, Robot?
Yes, I get it. This just isn't very funny.
Mate, in all of the other episodes, you've made terrible jokes as well, so you can at least pretend to laugh at that one. But anyway, it's well weird down here. Very murky and difficult to see. The sunlight doesn't really get very far down, so it's a good job we've got some bright headlights and the Botodex to help us out. Certainly a very interesting place to be. The fish down here look really strange, almost as weird looking as some of our presenters.
Wow, so sassy.
So, here's my question today. Why is it so difficult to get to the bottom of the ocean? See, we're not making much progress here. Well, the bottom of the ocean looks like being a lot further away than I thought. It says that most of the seafloor lies between 4,000 and 6,000 metres below sea level. That's like 6 kilometres. This is called the abyssal zone. Whoa, check this out. There are also trenches which are twice as deep as that. That's like 12 kilometres down. There is a lot of water down here, basically, but there are lots of reasons to make the effort to visit the ocean floor. It says there are cables down here which bring us the internet. And not many things are more important than the internet. I think we can all agree on that one.
It's okay in moderation.
Also, there's a lot of scientists interested in the fish and plants down here, but they have to be really tough to survive in the conditions so far down. So we can learn quite a bit from them. There's also loads of things that have never, ever been seen before.
I have literally never seen a fish as ugly as that one there.
I mean, that is pretty ugly. Looks like there's something else that people are interested in, and that's oil. It's found under the ocean floor, and engineers have to come up with ways to go really, really deep. So, what have you got for us, Botodex? Hey, you're like this. It says robots and remotely controlled vessels are used to locate and mine for the oil.
Robots, broccoli, are very handy like that.
Yep, and robots and machines can cope better with the biggest problem facing deep sea explorers, the pressure. Now, when you're on dry land, there's pressure all around from the air. But because it's equal to the pressure inside our bodies, we don't notice it. But, and here's the thing, go down just 10 metres underwater and the pressure increases by 15 pounds per square inch.
Yikes. That's like the weight of a medium-sized dog on every inch of your body. You would be squished. Death by dog.
Now, people can dive down hundreds of feet if they're specially trained and have the right equipment. But much more than that, and then, yeah. Let's just say it wouldn't end well. At a kilometre under sea level, the pressure is 1,500 pounds per square inch. That's like the weight of a small car pushing on every single square inch. Now, that's enough to kill you. Easy. So you can see how even machines have to be incredibly tough to be able to withstand that pressure without crumpling like an old pop can.
Yes, I do not want to crumple like an old pop can.
So deep sea submarines, the ones that go deeper than anything else, they have to have very thick hulls. Their windows are made of super thick glass, and they're often quite a lot smaller than the normal type of submarines. And people will only be able to travel in a small compartment. Even the most up-to-date sea slugs can't reach all of the ocean floor. So who knows what else might be out there?
More really ugly fish, I bet.
Sean's Science Around Ships. With support from Lloyd's Register Foundation. Find out more at funkidslive.com/ships.
Yeah, find out loads more on our website. You can also download all the episodes of Sean's Ships for free on your phone or tablet. Get to iTunes and the free Fun Kids app. We will chat to Sean Manus, who is a computer programmer and a tech genius, all about his brand new book, Coder Academy, which is going to help you get inside the internet in just a sec. First, I want to say a huge hello to Eva, right? She's a true Fun Kids Science Weekly hero. She's gone to iTunes on the podcast store, and she's left us a lovely review on there. And in it, she asks if any person alive right now will ever live on Mars. Now, Eva, a few weeks ago on this show, we chatted to the astronaut Tim Peake, and he spent 6 months in space on the International Space Station, and he said that we're looking to get to Mars one day and that we're going to use the moon as a kind of space service station on our way there. So, you know, when you're in the car, right, on the motorway with your family, and you pull over, you know, to stretch your legs, to have a little go at the loo as well, that's what space scientists are hoping the moon will become on our future trips to Mars. So yes, one day I think we will get to live there, but I'm not sure if anyone alive right now will actually do it. But thank you so much, though, Eva, for leaving us a review. If you want a shout-out on this show, that is the best way to do it. Get to the iTunes podcast store and find the Fun Kids Science Weekly. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, our guest this week is helping to make you a tech genius. Sean McManus, he's written the new book. It's Coder Academy, and it takes you inside a computer, seeing how it all works. Sean, welcome along. Hello.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, Dan.
Now, computers, so they only understand specific language. What I want to ask is why, when we started to make them, did we not develop them with a language that we could understand just as easily? Why is it this kind of cryptic code?
Ah, that's a really good question. So computers understand lots of different languages, and we've created languages for different purposes. So when it comes down to it, inside the computer, everything is just a one or a zero. It's just an electrical signal is on or it's off. And we need a way to turn that into something we can understand. So languages that exist include C++, which is used for a lot of developing games. The kind of console games you play will often have been written using that. It's really good for creating fast games, you know, where performance really matters and you really want that blistering speed. And then there are languages like Scratch, which are much easier to program. They're much more visual. There's a lot less typing to do, and they're accessible to everyone. And lots of people now, a lot of listeners, will be using that in schools already, I think.
So tell me more about the ones that help me play games online, maybe these quick, all-fire games. How does it relate to what I'm pressing on my keypad? How is that then going down the wire and instantaneously appearing on the screen?
So if you're doing online gaming, I guess some of the work will be done on your computer and some of the work will be done in the cloud, which is the computer that the game provider owns. And they need to split it that way, because the one that they own is everybody can connect to, and so it can coordinate between the different players and make that all work. And also they can keep things in there to stop people from cheating. So if they keep things like your credits and your score in that part of it, then they can stop people from hacking that system a little bit and getting an unfair advantage. And then on your computer are the things that need to happen fast. So it would be rendering the graphics, because the slow bit is connecting between the two.
So let's get down to right base level then. Tell me about code. How does it all work inside a computer? How is it made from the bottom up?
Okay, so code is, it's like a recipe, really. If you want to tell somebody how to make a cake, you give them the instructions. You say, okay, you're going to need these ingredients and you're going to need to combine them in these ways. Do this bit first and then that bit. And for a computer, you give instructions in a similar way. So you might say, okay, you use this graphic and you put that image there. And then when this happens, you play that sound. And so you give it like almost like a to-do list of things the computer has to do, and it works its way through them from top to bottom. And sometimes the instructions will tell it to go and do another set of instructions, and it will branch off a different path. But it is basically just writing instructions that tell it what to do in minute detail.
And how do the computers learn what we want them to do? How do we develop the language that they understand?
Ah, that's a good question. So we have lots of different ways of converting between the stuff that we type in and the language that we write in, and the zeros and ones that happen at the computer level. So some languages are interpreted, which means that as the program runs, it takes the next instruction and then converts it and then runs it. And that's a little bit slower, but those languages tend to be easier to work with. And then some languages are compiled, which means that there's a program that goes through at the start and it turns everything into that lower level code, and then it all gets run in one go. And that tends to be fast because that conversion isn't happening while the program is running.
Now, so clearly coding, it's the present, and it's going to be very much still part of the future, so much that we need to learn it in schools right now. You've got the book, it's Coder Academy. Tell me more about how you are teaching us to code through this book.
Okay, so one of the things that I'm really delighted with about this book, and it comes from the whole team that's worked on it, is that it uses a combination of things that happen on the page and things that happen on the screen as well. One of the things that I've found when I'm writing software is actually a lot of the creative work happens away from the screen. That's when you're having the ideas sometimes, and that's when you're suddenly making those breakthroughs in how you're going to make the next thing work. And so the book uses activities on the page, such as turning a pattern into music, which is a great new way of creating music in code. Shows you how you can design a character first on the page and then turn it into something on the screen and then drop that into a simple game. So it takes you through those processes. Sometimes the valuable stuff happens away from the screen, and the book respects that.
Computers, they do all manner of things. So from simple base level computers of just adding 1 + 1 on a calculator, right the way through to me playing as a character that I've designed on a game, then all the way through to landing astronauts on the moon. How is the language that computers use different across all the range of computers that we have available to us?
Well, the surprising thing is that some of the languages we use today have actually been with us a very long time. So some of those languages have been with us decades. Some of the languages are highly specialised for the processor they're working on. And, you know, computer processors and the hardware, that changes fairly often. So every couple of years, there's a massive upgrade in what we're able to do with technology, which is why today's games look better than the games from 5 years ago and 5 years before that. And as those new processors come out, new instructions are required for them as well. So that there are evolutions, but the higher level languages tend to be relatively stable.
And who's making these instructions? Who's telling the computer that's only just been invented and is so much powerful than things we had barely a year previously? Who's telling these what to think?
Well, I guess one of the things that manufacturers want is they don't want everything to suddenly be broken. And so what they aim for is backwards compatibility. They want yesterday's software to work on today's computers and tomorrow's computers as far as possible. But in order to get that extra performance out, it tends to be those who are really driving software today. So games developers, they work really hard. When a processor manufacturer puts a new feature in the chip that makes it faster, they want to be using it because all of a sudden their games work better and it's a much more exciting experience for players.
If you think back to, as I say, when the calculator first came around, they would have no idea of where computers are at now. Do scientists have any clue possibly what might be down the line in terms of coding and processing in a decade, 10 years' time?
The only thing we found with predictions like that is that they tend to turn out to be wrong. But I guess people tend to underestimate the impact that these things will have in the longer term and overestimate in the short term. So, you know, it might be a while before we see big changes, but, you know, in 10 or 20 years, we're going to see a lot with robotics. We're going to see a lot with artificial intelligence. And we're going to see that actually starts changing society. It starts changing the kind of jobs that are out there, starts changing how we interact with businesses, and, you know, starts changing how we own data and how we use it.
Now, I know that your book makes it very easy to learn about coding, but what do you think's the hardest thing to learn about coding and about computing? What's really tough to get your head around?
That's a tricky question. I think one of the things that's hardest for a programmer is probably when you're working in those mission critical situations. So if you are writing the code that's going to land a man or a woman on the moon, you know that code really needs to work perfectly every time. So it needs to be totally bulletproof. And I imagine it must be quite stressful being part of that team. In terms of complexity, I don't really know. there are people who are pushing the forefront in academia who are really looking at what we can do next and inventing new techniques that will take some years to trickle down. So it might be a while before we see the really cutting edge stuff.
Well, perfect. And hopefully we'll have a whole wave of people that are up there and ready to design the computers with the new book. It's Coder Academy. Sean McManus, thank you so much for coming on Fun Kids.
Thanks very much for having me, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Now we'll take a look at the war that's going on between heroes and villains right now in your body in just a sec. First, let's get something mean and deadly on the show with this week's Dangerous Dan. Today it is the Golden Poison Dart Frog. It's possibly the coolest name of animal that I've ever heard, right? It's instantly changed everything that I thought I knew about frogs. Right, are you the same? Did you think that all frogs were green, slimy, and kind of waddly? Yeah, these ones, they're anything but. They're found in the rainforests in South America. They're brightly coloured, sparkling yellow, and they're pretty tiny, right? They only grow to about the size of a paperclip, 2 inches. But their size is an absolute lie of just how dangerous they are. Their skin is covered in a poison. It's called batrachotoxin. And a tiny amount, just a little drop of this poison, is enough to kill a human. And it's so potent as well, their poison, that there's enough in one golden poison dart frog to kill 10 grown men. And they're so deadly, these frogs, they're used as a weapon. Because the Embera people in South America, they cover the tips of blow darts that they use for hunting in the wild with the frog's poison. Which means that one of the smallest creatures in the jungle, the golden poison dart frog, it can take down some of the biggest predators. It is the Fun Kid Science Weekly. Now we'll get one of your questions answered by our science expert, Tom, in just a sec. First, we're diving into your body, having a look at the world of microbiology with our two bacteria best mates, right? We've got Benny and we've got Mao. And today we're having a look at fungus.
Good Bugs, Bad Bugs, with support from the Society for General Microbiology. Microbes get everywhere. They're on us, in us, and around us. If you've got a microscope, like me, you can see them for yourself. Look!
All right there.
That's Benny. He's a helpful sort of microbe. Lots of microbes are.
Not you again. Can't you leave us in peace?
And that's Mal. He's not very nice. A few microbes are horrible, and they're called germs.
Charming. I'm not all that keen on you either.
Hey, easy, Mal, mate. You're not doing yourself any favours there.
So, what's up, guys?
Here, you'll like this. We thought you might like to meet some fun guys who like to hang out in some of the food you eat. Fungi. Because fungi are a type of microorganism, aren't they? Do you see what I did there?
I think you need a new joke book. That's a rotten joke. Fungi have quite a bit to do with rotting stuff, as it happens.
Look, you're jumping ahead there. Back up. You like mushrooms? A nice mushroom omelette? Well, mushrooms are fungi. What about blue cheese?
Lovely, stinky cheese.
Nice as a dip. Blue cheese gets its taste and smell from a fungus. Any vegetarians out there? Like a bit of corn? It's a mycoprotein. And you've got it, that's also a fungus. And did you know it's a type of fungus that makes bread rise?
Bread that doesn't rise would make a terrible bacon sandwich.
In fairness, many people like unleavened bread. That's the flat stuff. But if you do want it fluffy, you're going to need the help of a fungus dude with a really long name. Saccharomyces cerevisiae, or yeast to you and me.
Yeast's a bit catchier, isn't it? Easier to remember.
Fair point, Mal. Yeast is a single-celled fungus. The cells are actually oval in shape, a bit lemon-shaped, like very tiny lemons.
This will freak you out. As fungi are microorganisms, yeast is actually alive! Your bacon sandwich is alive!
So, what's the big deal? Anyway, they're not alive once you've baked the bread. The heat of the oven kills them! Best press on.
Now, I've seen dried yeast in a packet, and it doesn't look very busy.
Yeah, but like all living things, yeast needs food, water and warmth to grow. When you mix flour, sugar and warm water together, it all kicks off. The yeast uses the sugar as food and gives off carbon dioxide. That's a gas as it grows.
Load of windbags.
Harsh. The flour has something called gluten in it, which makes the dough sticky and stretchy, so the gas can't escape and gets trapped making bubbles. And that's how the bread dough rises and you get a nice fluffed up loaf. Mal? Mal? It seems Mal has nodded off. Best let him sleep for a bit. He's very grumpy when woken up. Well, even more grumpy than usual. See you in a bit.
Follow the adventures of Benny and Mal on funkidslive.com/bugs. Good Bug, Bad Bug. Produced with support from the Society for General Microbiology.
You can get all the Benny and Mal microbiology adventures for free. Get to funkidslive.com or have a listen on your phone or tablet over on iTunes and the Fun Kids app. Now, you know, right, don't you, that if you've got any science question at all, we can get it answered. So if there's something that you've heard at school, I don't know, by a smart teacher or one of your slightly silly mates that's kind of keeping you up at night, if you just don't believe it, if it's a niggle of an idea in your head that you just can't let rest, well, let me know and I will find an answer. I promise it can be as serious or silly as you fancy. Just make sure it's about science, send it to my page over at funkidslive.com and we'll get our expert Tom to answer it. So today's question, Olivia, who is 10, thank you for sending yours over at funkidslive.com. Tom, she has asked, what is the relationship of gravity to the other basic forces of the universe?
Well, I really like this question, and mostly because we don't really have any idea why it's the case or how do they relate. In fact, Einstein died with this as his final... This was going to be his final theory, the Grand Unified Theory, and he couldn't solve it. So the other basic forces of the universe, rather than gravity, we have gravity, we have electromagnetic. So this is within magnets, why they come together and why they repel. You also have something called the strong force. Now, this is at the centre of atoms, and it acts like a hook because electromagnetism is trying to push these protons away from each other. When they get close enough, they hook together and overcome that force. Then there's also the weak force, and the weak force is related to why atoms decay. So things like nuclear waste, how long will that take to dispose of, is to do with the weak force. Now, electromagnetic, strong and weak, we have a pretty good idea that those are all related. One way of explaining it is like how ice, liquid water and steam are related. So it's three phases of the same thing. And we can, with maths, prove that there's a similar sort of relationship between those three theories or forces. But gravity, we can't get in there. And where we can't fit it together is at the tiny, tiny level, the quantum level. Now, one theory is string theory. String theory says that the distances we're talking about are so small they don't exist. You can't go that small. But unfortunately with string theory is that it tends to get more and more complex the more and more we understand it.
So Einstein died wondering this question.
Oh, yes.
And so those are the basic forces of the universe. Are scientists thinking at all that there might be other basic forces that we don't know about?
Right now, we're fairly sure those are the four. But there are things we don't know, and there are things that we don't know we don't know. So there's always the possibility there'll be more forces.
It is time for all the sciencey stuff in the news this week. After 113 years, live weather data is being taken at the top of Britain's highest mountain because researchers, they've installed a weather station at the peak of Ben Nevis in Scotland. And that means researchers and scientists, they'll now be able to open up their laptop at home in their nice warm lounges and have a look at what the weather is doing in the snowy sky up in Scotland. Also, a discovery in space has changed everything that scientists thought they knew about supernovas. You see, a supernova is what happens when stars die. They explode in a single shimmering blast. But one star in the sky has been called a zombie because it kept erupting and blowing up for over 2 years. And finally, a giant otter that lived in China 6 million years ago that we found recently, scientists think it could be a top prehistoric predator, because they reckon its strong, thick, heavy jaw could have killed all manner and eaten all the animals that otters usually don't. It's big news for prehistoric fossils. Right, let's get an extreme animal challenge up on the show. We're pitting man versus animal right now. Today, it's a race to the top.
Extreme athlete challenge with the Society of Biology.
Just as the competition is about to begin, we're pitting man against animal once again in our extreme athlete challenge. Today we're at the mountains because it's all about climbing. Who can climb the highest? For the humans, we have Dean Potter.
He's famous for free climbing, which is where the climber uses only their hands, feet and other parts of the body to ascend.
And our animal competitor, the gecko.
Geckos are lizard-like reptiles. They're small, but don't let that fool you. He has a few tricks up his scaly sleeve.
They're limbering up, ready, steady, and they're off.
Potter's pulling himself up the wall using his incredible strength alone. He's seeking out small crevices and bumps to use as tiny platforms.
He's managed to climb over 3,000 feet up vertical rock surfaces this way. An incredible athlete.
Look, the gecko is literally racing ahead. Never mind climbing. He can run up walls as quickly as on the ground. This is thanks to millions of tiny, unique hairs on his feet. They're called setae and act like glue.
Higher and higher they go, but the gecko is taking the lead. He can suspend his weight from one fingertip, and he doesn't need the bumps Dean Potter needs to step upon. We have a clear winner. The best climber and winner of our Extreme Athlete Challenge is the gecko.
Well done, gecko.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
Yaha, we've got all our extreme athlete challenges, man versus animal. You can find them all on the Free Fun Kids app, on iTunes and at funkidslive.com. That is it then, at the end of another rip-roaring, nerve-jangling and hair-raising edition of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We'll be back with more next week. We're chatting to a venom expert on the show. A venom expert. Seriously, that's his actual job title. Should be a fun talk. Remember, you can get all of our science series for free on iTunes and on the Free Fun Kids app, and you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that Free Fun Kids app, and online at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.